So we've started a series on really the life of David, but David's life is entwined with these characters of King Saul, the first king of Israel, and his son, Prince Jonathan. So the three characters go together. Last week we looked at the story of David and Goliath. We just reviewed this a little bit. Let's see if I got this. There we go. I think that was me. Perfect. So David defeated the great giant, and we all know that story from many early years. David defeating Goliath with only a sling. When that story was being told by Tom, I was mindful of a trip in Bolivia where I was with the guide, and we were going to Torotoro, actually, where we were recently with the youth. And the guide had a big slingshot around his neck, and it was big, it was noticeable. And that was a message to everybody: stay back, don't try anything goofy, because I've got this slingshot and I know how to use it. So it's interesting, in Bolivia, it's very much a tool, it's a weapon. They don't have guns as such, but he was communicating, I've got this one individual with me, and we're out here for a few days. Just be careful. And so my friend wore his slingshot. And so David was very skilled in that, even as my guide was. As the story goes on, and I would encourage you to read, actually, from 1 Samuel into 2 Samuel, if you're so interested, to get a bit of a background on what these sermons are about. But David becomes a military leader and becomes very popular with the populace, as we've just heard, in the singing of this song. So Saul then, of course, is going to react to that, become suspicious. It's actually interesting that the way the NRC has translated this, it goes to verse 7, Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands. So the word that's actually used there for tens of thousands is the word multitude or myriad. He has killed many. So it's not necessarily the intention of the women to say that Saul has killed some and David has killed way more. They're using this language to say that all this has happened. And I point that out because it's interesting that Saul then interprets that in this negative way. It doesn't have to be interpreted that way. David has killed thousands. I mean, Saul has killed thousands and David has killed this multitude. So it depends how you perceive it. So Saul hears the words and he perceives it this way, and it's of course the way that the translators, the NRSV, use as well. But in the Hebrew text, it's not that clear. So I say that because a lot happens just by the way he interprets this very verse. If he had have said, the women, because it's joyful, they're singing, they're dancing, they've just defeated the Philistines. Saul has killed many. And David has killed many as well. The women are not trying necessarily to say that David is better than Saul. It's way too early in the story to think that. David's popularity is growing. He's young, he's attractive, sure. But King Saul is also impressive. But he perceives it this way. So it's one of the challenges we have whenever we compare. Teresa Avila said that comparison is the death of the spiritual life. Pretty strong language. She was the head of a convent, and one of the issues that she saw so strongly in the convent were the nuns actually comparing themselves with one another in terms of their spirituality. I've told that story before. Comparison is the death of the spiritual life, and here, Saul, you see, this comparison between him and David doesn't serve him very well. So there we go at the beginning. We have these individuals. So I'm calling this the contrast of a father and son. Many father-son stories in the scriptures, but this is one of them. And it's all important because David ultimately becomes this great king, right? King of Israel. Even still, Israel, it's such a huge story in Israel today. It's a major story in CNN right now on the the impact of the evangelicals on what is going in the United States and what is going on in the West Bank in Israel. Because there are those who would interpret Israel is to be in charge of all of what the old Israel was. The territory of David and Solomon, I'm not saying that's wrong as such, but they are interpreting that all of that should come back to Israel today. And so the evangelicals are saying, yes, that's exactly what I believe, and that should happen. But what happens then is they continue to expand into the West Bank, which is where the Palestinians have lived for 1,000 years. And so they're saying, well, forget the Palestinians, just we want all that land back. And it all goes back to this story. King David's not even king yet. And it's ultimately his son, Solomon, that extends the kingdom so far. But the story continues on even to our day. So this story is more relevant than we might think. It's not just an ancient narrative. It has impact on what's going on in the Middle East, even in these days, whatever position one takes. Should Israel have it all? Should they not? Should there be two states or not? I mean, you're all aware of such arguments. But the point is the story is relevant for us. And so we begin with King Saul. And Saul was chosen, was anointed by Samuel to be king. The text tells us that God didn't even really want a king. He didn't. But the people demanded that there is a king like the other nations. So God said, well, okay, if that's what you want, then we'll do that. He chooses Saul. But as Saul goes, he has some weaknesses, and one is that he wants to please everybody. So that's where the story goes. Just a comment as we begin. There are these terms that are used through these three chapters of chapter 18, 19, and 20 of 1 Samuel. And the word love is repeated. Solomon's love for David and David's love for Jonathan, those two back and forth. Love. They loved one another. Secondly, David's success. And he finds success because the Lord is with him. So those terms are repeated over and over. So it's a narrative story. We're hearing the narrative, but the writer is still emphasizing certain themes. The love, the success, and God being with David. So David is succeeding because God is with him. That story is going to be emphasized. So we look at the father, and the first theme that comes through is the jealousy of King Saul. We see it in that phrase at the end there, Saul eyed David. I think that's pretty strong language. And that's not a good eye. That is what we might call the evil eye. Verse 18:9. So Saul eyed David from that moment on. If you travel through that part of the world, they have a blue stone with a black eye in the middle of it, and it's called the evil eye. And the people, it's a good luck charm now. That's what it is, a good luck charm. But the evil eye goes all the way back. See? 1,500 years before Christ, the evil eye, that was there, and the writer uses it here. So Saul eyed David from that day on. We might not use that word, but the writer does. So jealousy. Jealousy screws up our sight. It divides us. It distracts us when we are jealous, when we're overcome with jealousy. So, for example, if we just look at James, let's say, because the New Testament talks about it, James uses the language twice here in James chapter 3. So let me just read a few verses before we carry on. James 3:14-16. And in the New Testament, it's often translated as envy. It's the Greek word zelos. And zelos can be envy or it can be jealousy. And Paul encourages us not to fall into either of those. James 3, verse 13, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness born of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy," that's the word jealousy, "and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be boastful and false to the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, devilish. For where there is envy," that's the word jealousy, "and selfish ambition, there will also be disorder and wickedness of every kind." This is written by James, the brother of Jesus. I wonder if James was ever jealous of Jesus. What do you think? Jesus is a brother, the oldest brother. And maybe James wondered, why does Jesus get all the attention? I don't know, I'm just wondering. There could be jealousy, there could be envy there. But that kind of thought can work its way into our stories and into our lives. You can also look at Galatians 5:24 if you reference that. That's also the word jealousy. In fact, it's translated there as jealousy. So jealousy does not serve Saul well. And I would say we also have to watch that in our own lives. We are not immune to such things. One thing we can keep in mind with Saul. Secondly, is anger. Bonnie read that he tries to pin David to the wall. And in fact, in chapter 19, verse 1, he announces to the court that he wants David killed. So if you look at 1 Samuel 19, let me just reference this, 19:1. "Saul spoke to his son Jonathan and to all his servants about killing David." So it becomes public at that point, right? Previously, he's trying to pin David to the wall, but that's in the inner court. There's only a few around. Now he's announcing he wants this individual killed. One who just not that long before had killed Goliath and was a hero in the court, and we're also told that Saul loved him. But things have now changed. So there's this story of anger. Jealousy can lead to anger. What do you think? You ever felt that in your life? Won't ask you to raise your hands, but maybe. Maybe some jealousy has happened there somewhere along the line, and maybe that's led to some anger. The two kind of go together. So David becomes very angry with this one who is growing in popularity with the people. And then we're also told, thirdly, that he's full of fear. And you can read this one, 1 Samuel 20, 31, where Saul talks to his son Jonathan and says, "Look, if David continues to rise like this, you will never have your kingdom. The kingdom will be taken from me and from you." That's the argument there, 1 Samuel 20, 31. And of course, the irony here is that is actually quite true. And it is true because David is not rising because of his own ambition. He's rising because God has anointed him. Samuel has anointed him. He's on the rise. So King Saul sees it all right, but he won't accept it. Jonathan sees it and accepts it. And so we have these three characteristics of Saul so far. We have his jealousy, we have his anger, and we have his fear. And frequently those three can go together even for us today. Jealousy, anger, fear. We're looking at a story, this individual, an important person, and this is characteristic of his life. And then fourthly, it leads to this hardening of Saul's heart because he becomes completely preoccupied with David. There's all kinds of good stuff happening in his kingdom right now. Philistines are being conquered, peace in the land, but he just focuses more and more and more on David, and it's really irrational. And that could happen to us too. All kinds of good stuff in your life can be happening, but you focus on this one thing, this one screwy thing that you don't like. And we can become preoccupied with that, just like Saul did. It can be our families, it can be our friends, it could be the church. Preoccupation. So we see with Saul, it's determined and it's calculated. He is going to kill David. He is going to gather his forces, and we are going to search for him because David is going to flee by the end of 1 Samuel 20, which is our text. So it's a hardening of heart. And in fact, interesting here, because it's not translated this way, in 1 Samuel 20, 31, Saul says to his son Jonathan, David is the son of death. And it's too bad it's not translated that way, because that's a very powerful statement. 20:31. It's translated in our text this way. For he shall surely die, NRC says. Literally, it is son of death. Son of death. King Saul to his son Jonathan. He is the son of death. That pretty much sums the whole thing up. In our English text, it says, for he shall surely die. So that's being preoccupied. And all of these things can kind of work in our own lives in the very same way. Here we have them: jealousy, anger, fear, and a hardened heart. A heart that is just preoccupied with this one thing. In the world of the rich, apparently, whoever has the biggest yacht on the planet is a big thing. They have no idea how to sail a boat. Who could possibly sail a boat 300 feet long? You have to have pilots, and you have to have everybody doing it. But it becomes a thing. And so somebody out there who's very, very rich has this huge yacht. And then the next guy says, well, he shouldn't have the big yacht. I want the biggest yacht. So he's got the money and he has the yacht built. There's stories on, in the midst of the poorness and the poverty in the world right now, there are a bunch of people with a lot of money and they're building big yachts. Those big yachts are, those companies are doing better than ever because people want to have them. So it's this issue of comparison, of hardening our heart and whatever it might be. So in this kind of preaching, right, it's a talking about a narrative here, a story. You know, you have to do your work here and ask yourself, well, where does this fit in my life? I can't tell you where those issues are, but they're there at some point. Jealousy, anger, fear, a hardened heart. We can all be prone to that at some level. And if not, then wonderful. That's great. On a macro scale, what the story is telling us is that God is involved in human history. God is involved in the way the kingdoms are working. God is involved in all of that, and his purposes ultimately will be achieved, whether we want them or not. King Saul does not want David to succeed. He wants to kill him. But if you've read through 1 Samuel, we know that David has already been anointed by Samuel at God's direction. Bring me the seven brothers, and I will pick the one I want. This is God's word to Samuel. He picks them, he has them anointed. The reader already knows that David is the appointed one. Saul doesn't know that. That's not part of his story. We, the reader, knows that. So the truth is that God is going to do his work, right? At least the writer believes that. Scriptures in the New Testament, I think, teach us the same thing. God will do his thing. So are we in line with that or no? Or are we going to fight it and resist it at every step, just as King Saul did? So we can resist. We can think we're doing right and not be doing right at all in terms of God's eyes. So we always have to sit back and say, finally, God, your will be done. Jesus in Gethsemane doesn't get that at partly that he is to die. Is there any other way out of this? If it can be, Jesus prays, may it happen. But he concludes finally, but your will be done. So finally, we all need to finally go there. Your will be done. Your will be done. Your will be done. We want this property next door to be built. Your will be done. Right now, condos aren't being sold very well, right? So the whole thing is on hold. Your will be done. Your will be done. If it's God's will, it will happen. If it is not God's will for some reason, then you know what? It won't happen. And what we finally have to say is, God, your will be done. We trust in you. We have confidence in you. So as a church, we have to do that, but you need to do it in your own life, and so do I, at whatever level. That is what King Saul is dealing with. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on there. And then we turn and we look at his son Jonathan. What about Jonathan? We're told, here are some texts you can just keep in mind. He's introduced in John 8, in Samuel 18. What the story we're going to read today in a moment in 20, that's really the end of their friendship, apart from one meeting, which happens in 23. So these are the texts about Jonathan, begins here in 18. And their friendship or love is based on a covenant. And the word covenant is used, bereath. They have made a pact. They have made a covenant. David to Jonathan, Jonathan to David. Bigger than the issue of who has the kingdom or not. They have made this bereath with one another. And the good news is God has made this bereath with us, hasn't he? We have a new covenant. Jeremiah talks about it, and we read about it when we do communion every month. God has made a new covenant with us. It's the same word, bereath. So God has made this covenant with you, with me. It's a covenant. Wow. And it's that word that defines their friendship, a covenant together. And secondly, it's based on this word chesed. Chesed, loving kindness, mercy, faithful love. That word is normally applied to God with the people Israel, God with us, chesed. But here we have it between these two individuals. David has this love, chesed love, for Jonathan, and Jonathan has it for David. The repetition of the word love, the verb, is used over and over and over. So that's the second piece. It's also defined by loyalty and by humility. Jonathan is the rightful prince. And Jonathan says, the kingdom is going to be yours, my friend David, and not mine. I will be your prince. That language is used. But you are going to be king. There's a certain humility, don't you think, in that? The David... Jonathan is the rightful prince, in one sense. He's the son of the king, but he's prepared to diminish as David rises. It's the same kind of love that we have between John the Baptist and Jesus. John the Baptist is ready to decrease while Jesus increases, his cousin. Wouldn't have to be that way, right? John the Baptist could say, hey man, I'm the guy, I'm the big guy, I'm the prophet. And he was the first prophet in Israel after Malachi. That's a huge thing. He could have been saying, this is my time, man. But he doesn't. But finally, and fourthly with this, it's a whole story that requires waiting. David has to wait, and he does wait. He doesn't take it by force. He has a chance to kill Saul later, but he won't do it because he's the king. I will wait. And Jonathan wants this whole thing figured out. It's not very good. Imagine living with his dad at that point. He wants it figured out too, but he's called to wait. So waiting is part of the spiritual life, big part. We are all called at many times to watch and to wait. To wait upon God. So you may be in a situation right now where you are called to wait. The church, we're called to wait right now. Obviously, we're waiting. How do we wait? Do we wait and be uptight and distracted and divided, or can we wait with hope and trust that God's timing is right? David and Jonathan wait. So the whole thing, right, is kind of messy. There's a lot of things going on in this story of friendship. Note some of them: risk, pain, hurt, hope, and faith. You know what? Any kind of friendship requires some of this. Friendships aren't clean. It's not like it's 100% every way forever, and particularly if they go on for a number of years. Friendships can go up and down, up and down. That's the story of it. So can we continue on and keep trusting and depending and leaning on God even as we work through those situations? But again, what is it about ultimately? That God is doing this new work. God is doing a new thing. That language is used in the prophets. God is telling King Saul, Saul, you're not going to continue on to be king. I mean, he's told him that. For whatever reasons, it's not happening. David's going to ultimately be king. So a new time, a new thing. And Saul doesn't get it. Jonathan has his own struggles. David doesn't even really get it. But there are times when new things happen. A new kingdom emerges. God does a new work in the people of God. I'm going to find it interesting to see what happens in the United States with Trump becoming president on Monday. That's going to create a bunch of changes in lots of ways. And it will cascade over the border into our land a bit. I'm not sure how that will work out. But things are going to change. For better or for worse, but they're going to change. And can we keep trusting in God? Maybe God is going to do a new work somehow. We don't know. I read Zelensky yesterday. He was saying that he now trusts that something good will come out of President Trump being, well, he'll be the president. Of course, before he was not very pleased with it, right? He was trusting in Biden. Things change. Now he's saying, I'm hoping, trusting that it will happen. You can read the stories. Probably smart move on his part. But how will this new kingdom come, right? And so I think all of us, at all times, we're called to kind of open our eyes and open our hearts because we simply don't know. God knows. So we see this contrast between father and son. And we note that we're probably in there a little bit on both sides. There's probably some jealousy going on there somewhere. Envy. Maybe a bit of anger. A little fear, maybe. We're not immune from such things. But in the midst of that, we can look. God is committed to us. God is a patient God, is he not? He is a patient God. He takes the long view all the time. He's patient. And so he's patient with us even as we struggle in our own ways. And then finally, we know that God will continue to use us in the midst of all this. We are his vessels. You are his vessel. Offer yourself to him, even with whatever tensions you have in yourself. God knows us better than we know ourselves. And he's able to see the jewel in your heart, regardless of whatever tarnish there might be there. A jewel. He sees it. He's your creator. He knows you. He loves you. Chesed for you. A bereath covenant for you. So may we hear something from these stories. Read 1 Samuel 18, 19, and 20 this week. particularly 20 at the end, because there they are weeping together, because they know that this is the end. Note, story going on. David rose from beside the stone heap and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He bows three times before his friend, Jonathan. He bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept with each other, and David wept the more. It's a very painful story. This is ultimately the last time really they're going to have together in a prolonged way. And so the story is powerful. So that kind of emotion fills the stories. May we hear some of it and learn something from it together. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.